W.W. Phelps. That's funny. Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. W.W. Phelps was deeply involved in partisan political fights in the newspaper industry in New York prior to his joining the church in the 1830s. In our next conversation with his biographer, Dr. Bruce Van Orden, the author of We'll Sing and We'll Shout, The Life and Times of W.W. Phelps, we'll talk about Phelps' involvement in the Missouri Troubles. Did his partisanship in New York come with him to Missouri and stir up trouble with the saints there? We'll find out what Dr. Van Orden thinks in our next conversation. You won't want to miss it. Check it out. Well, so let me ask you this. W.W. Phelps, when he was in New York, kind of got involved in a lot of the political tussles in New York, as you mentioned, the anti-Masonic party and that sort of thing. How much of the problems in Missouri were because of his pugnacious, I guess, attitudes in the newspaper industry?
The word pugnacious is fair, but it is unfair to place all the blame on Phelps, and some people have done that. Mm-hmm. Because he was a newspaper editor, people knew about him. His name was on the business, and it was right next to the courthouse, and people knew about Phelps. But he was not alone. It was also the rhetoric that was used in public speaking and an interchange between the Mormons and the Mormons called the original settlers Gentiles, which was not interpreted as a nice phrase, you Gentiles. Mm-hmm. So it was the argumentation that often took place on the streets. And people like Sidney Rigdon, when he was in Zion, speaking so pugnaciously, and Joseph Smith also identifying himself. There were others. McClellan was a resident there in Independence, and he spoke vehemently also. So it was a combination of the Latter-day Saint attitudes that we are better than you are, and you guys might be destroyed as Jesus comes to cleanse the earth and establishes the New Jerusalem right here, and he will protect us, and he will probably destroy you. It was that type of rhetoric. And a bit of that slipped into the Times, in the Evening and the Morning Star, but it was not Phelps alone who was responsible for this.
Who are some of the other people that we...
Well, I'd say Sidney Rigdon, David Whitmer, John Whitmer, Oliver Cowdery, William E. McClellan, probably Edward Partridge, Isaac Morley, John Corll.
So quite a few.
Yeah.
Do you think... So could they have lived there in peace if they'd have been a little less combative?
No doubt about it. But the reason they were combative is because they felt that this was the New Jerusalem and that Christ would be coming quite soon. They felt that. Mm-hmm. Even in the Evening and Morning Star, Phelps talked about the signs of the times and that they were telling us that the time is coming. In the Redeemer of Israel hymn, he said the tokens already appear, meaning the signs are already here to say that it's coming. And he wrote, I may be wrong in this, but I'm calculating this based on biblical evidence, and I think it might be 9 years from now he comes.
So you can understand why the Missourians were pretty upset.
Yes, I can certainly understand.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's too bad. I know Bishop Partridge was tarred and feathered, and then the press was scattered. We've mentioned the Book of Commandments. But the powder keg was this free people of color.
Sure, that's what set it off.
Is it pretty... would you say that was purposely misinterpreted by the Missourians and kind of... an excuse to destroy the press?
I think it was an excuse. They had been preparing for this for several weeks and months. Latter-day Saint structures and homes had been brick-batted, they called it, stones and bricks thrown at their homes and breaking windows several months earlier. They were preparing for this for quite some time.
Okay, so they just
And it was even written up in the Evening and the Morning Star, the opposition that was building and developing. And by the way, when this period of time was spoken about later in the official history of the church, it was Phelps who wrote about it. So, because he knew so much about all those events.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I know Partridge was tarred and feathered. Did Phelps, was he physically harmed?
They probably would have, but he escaped and stayed undercover, and they didn't get him.
Okay.
His wife had to flee, and as she ran away with her children, she left two behind in the rubble and didn't really realize it until she found a barn for safety, and then they had to go back and find a couple of the kids.
Oh, wow. How many kids did he have at that time?
Six.
Six kids. Wow. Which I guess that was a pretty common sized family back then.
Yes, and then they end up having three more, one that died, so two more that lived.
Okay. All right, so Phelps was able to escape a lot of the physical harm that
yes, others did at that point. Mm-hmm.
And so where did he go after after the raid in Jackson County?
Well, there were negotiations to try to stay, and things calmed down temporarily for a couple months, enough that they were living in peace again, and they were thinking, oh, I guess we'll be able to make it and even stay. But in the but they were urged to hire lawyers to defend their points of view about being mistreated and having their property destroyed and all of that, and to have lawsuits about all of that. And as soon as they hired these lawyers, the Missourians said, this is it. We're going to drive you completely out of town and out of the county, which they did then in late October, early November 1831. And they fled, for the most part, across the Missouri River into Clay County, where they were accepted as human beings and refugees and treated fairly, at least for a time.
Mm-hmm. And so Phelps was one of the leading people in charge of trying to get reparations or whatever?
Well, right? He was one of the leaders of the church. There were the seven presiding high priests, the three who worked in the printing office, Phelps, Cowdery, and John Whitmer, and then Partridge and his two counselors in the bishopric, Isaac Morley and John Corll. And then there was one other that made a group of seven high priests that presided over the church in Jackson County. And then when it came to the reparations, Phelps knew all about it. He knew quite a bit about the law. And so he and Partridge were the ones who hired, with church monies, the four attorneys. And they were the ones who were setting up lawsuits. And yes, they were leading the church. And then when Joseph Smith came with Zion's camp several months later to help redeem Zion, an attempt that didn't fulfill its objective, but a revelation came to Joseph Smith that there would then be a full-fledged church organization set up in Missouri, modeled after the one that had just been set up in Ohio, with a presidency and a high council. And so a church presidency in Missouri was established with a high council, and there were two church presidencies, the church presidency in Missouri, the church presidency in Ohio, presided over by the presidency of the high priesthood, but the presidency of the high priesthood were also the presidency in Ohio, so it made some confusion. But they were considered equal presidencies, presided over by the president of the high priesthood, Joseph Smith. But he was also the president of the church in Ohio. Well, anyway, Phelps was one of those presidents in Missouri. The president in Missouri was David Whitmer. He was fulfilling a promise made to him that he would have a very high authority. That was way back when he was one of the three witnesses. It turns out that David Whitmer, however, went right away after being called to that president to the East to help with other projects. And so when the church was being presided over in Clay County now in 1834 into 1835, it was W.W. Phelps and John Whitmer, the other member of that presidency, who presided over the church. So David Whitmer, even though he nominally had that post, didn't really function in that post. So Phelps was the presiding elder or presiding high priest in Missouri for quite some time, before leaving Jackson County and then into Clay County.
Would this essentially kind of be like a stake president now? Is that how you'd view it?
It would be like that. And many people say that it was a stake presidency, but it was not ever mentioned as a stake. the idea of stakes came up in 1837, not 1834, okay, when this was created. It was a presidency and a high council, which is like a stake now. But the a high council in those days was more important than anything else except the presidency. The apostles hadn't even been called.
Right.
And then when the apostles were called, they were considered not higher than a presidency and a high council. They were considered perhaps equal, but they were not to preside anywhere where there was a presidency and a high council, meaning in the Kirtland area and in Missouri where the church was. The 12 apostles would preside when they would go out into the world and set up branches, and they would preside out there. But the other presiding ones were the two presidencies. And this is why this association with Joseph Smith is so important, because over all those years, when Zion was established in Jackson County, then into Clay County, then into the Far West period, Joseph Smith interacted with the Missouri leadership all the time by letter. By letter. Mm-hmm. And it was Phelps who wrote back and forth, and that Ohio-Missouri axis is very important to realize, because there are two church headquarters at the same time, two presidencies. They were 800 some miles apart, and interaction was not easy, and there were miscommunications and misunderstandings and rivalries. But there were the two church headquarters at the same time. This is why this biography in its context is important, because it deals with this axis.
Yeah.
Axis.
Well, and that's kind of what struck me as, you know, I think it's hard enough, even with telephones and fax machines and email, it's hard to have two headquarters today, and it would have been even harder when you didn't have a telephone and everything had to be done by letter. And I mean, how much of the problems between Missouri and Ohio were just, I mean, does it seem like Joseph was biting off more than he could chew by having two headquarters, essentially?
Well, he was definitely enthusiastic, and he wanted to build the kingdom of God, and the sooner the better, because they figured the end was near. They later revelations indicated that Joseph Smith is going to be quite some time off before the second coming takes place, and it hasn't taken place yet all these centuries later. But they felt they had to get it done, and Missouri was the promised land, and these leaders in Missouri thought that Joseph Smith, you should live here, because this is the new Jerusalem, and why aren't you living here? And so they argued a little bit about that, and Joseph said, well, I've received revelation, I'm supposed to be in Ohio for the next 5 years. And then when the temple project had to come to an end in Jackson County, then he went forth with the temple project, much the same type of thing, in Ohio. Well, that's where in our history we look back on as our first temple and venerate it and everything. We look back now as a people and think, well, Ohio was even more important than Missouri, but not in the eyes of many of the people at the time, especially in those early days. So there were rivalries. The biggest rivalry actually was between Sidney Rigdon and Edward Partridge, former good friends, but they had a few different spats that had to be worked out. Section 85 of the Doctrine and Covenants talks about the one mighty and strong that could maybe replace Edward Partridge if he fell, and that one mighty and strong has caused all sorts of mischief in the eyes of many people in the church, some people thinking they are the guy. Well, that was in a letter that Joseph Smith wrote to W.W. Phelps, and that letter a few portions of it has been extracted and made into Section 85.
Oh, that's interesting. So there's so many ways we can go.
Oh, there's so
here.
Many interesting things to this.
Because I just want to talk about Sidney Rigdon and Edward Partridge for a second, because it was Rigdon's idea to have a bishop, right? Because there were no bishops prior, and Rigdon was...
Well, he brought it up. There's the question about whether it was revealed to have a bishop or not. According to the Doctrine and Covenants, it was a revelation. However, before that revelation came forth, Sidney Rigdon had brought up the idea. So, yeah. Yeah, you have to choose yourself about who started this.
And he was the first one. He ordained the first bishop, Bishop Partridge, right?
I can't remember if that happened that way or not.
Okay, I thought that
it could be. Yeah.
All right. So, so Phelps is kind of the de facto head of the Missouri Church. Is that
well,
right?
Well, at first it was this combination of high priests, and Phelps wrote in response to a request by George A. Smith way back in 1864, many years later. What was happening in Missouri in those early years? George A. Smith asked Phelps, and Phelps wrote a lengthy response telling what was going on. And he said that Joseph Smith assigned me to be the spiritual head of the church with Oliver Cowdery and John Whitmer as my assistants, whereas the temporal affairs head of the church was Bishop Partridge and his two assistants in the bishopric. In practice, it was all seven of these high priests working in harmony, making the decisions. They met in council all the time and made decisions, council decisions. Up until that new presidency was established at the end of Zion's camp in 1834.
Okay. So, yeah, I feel like we should talk a little bit about Zion's camp. What can you tell us about that? Because that's kind of that's where a lot of our church leaders came from, right?
Absolutely. All of the original 70s and 9 of the original 12 apostles were participants in the Zion's camp march. The other 3 were actually residents of Missouri. Thomas Marsh, Parley P. Pratt. Well, he wasn't one of the other 3. He actually participated in the march, but he had been a resident of Jackson County and had represented Missouri Saints after being driven out of Jackson County. He represented the Missouri Saints in going back to Ohio and reporting what had happened, being driven out. And then he was part of the plan to establish this army that could come and join up with the organized official militia under the direction of the governor, Dunklin, in Missouri. And the two groups would then go in and enforce the fact that the Saints could go back to their officially owned lands in Jackson County and once again live there. Well, Dunklin caved, knowing that there would be a civil war, because in the meantime, the Jackson County vigilantes had actually built up their reinforcements with arms and people and members of their county militia and had joined up with other county militias nearby who agreed with them, and there would have been an outright civil war, no question about it, and the Mormons probably would have been routed because they didn't have that many arms to deal with 3 or 4 counties fighting them. And Joseph Smith could see this when he arrived and sought God's will and got it in sections 103 and, mostly 105, saying that for the time being, Zion will not be redeemed. In the meantime, we will plan to have everybody endowed with the power of God from on high in the house of the Lord in Ohio. And we're calling all of you guys in Missouri, who are going to be the presidency, the high council, and the bishopric, to prepare yourselves spiritually and go to Ohio and there receive your endowment of power from on high, and then come back, and we'll get Zion redeemed when it's God's will. That was section 105. And then Joseph Smith returned, and David Whitmer went with him. That left W.W. Phelps and John Whitmer and the high council to preside over the Clay County Saints, but they were also to go to Missouri, to Ohio, and they did several months later. And Phelps lived in Ohio then for 11 months, from May 1835 through April 1836, and was very much involved in 6 or 7 very important things in Ohio in that dramatic 11 months.
Because didn't he set up another press in Ohio?
It was actually Oliver Cowdery who set up the press. In fact, the press was functioning when Phelps arrived. Cowdery, having learned the printing art, went to New York City and obtained a new press for Ohio and was even editing the Latter-day Saints Messenger and Advocate by the time that Phelps arrived. And then when Phelps arrived, John Whitmer became the editor. He also trained in printing of the Messenger and Advocate. And with that printing press, they published the first edition of the Doctrine and Covenants.
Okay.
The hymn book, which is so important in this whole story.
How much did Emma have involvement in the hymn book? Because we always refer to Emma as being kind of the author, but it sounds like Phelps was quite involved.
A recent biography has appeared on Emma Smith by Jennifer Reeder, called First, and about the faith of Emma Smith. Jennifer asserts that Emma Smith fulfilled her calling given in section 25 of the Doctrine and Covenants to assemble the hymns and for the first hymnal of the Latter-day Saints, as if she essentially did it mostly by herself. There is no documentation of what she specifically did in any of her papers. She didn't keep a journal. Phelps, who did write a lot about his experiences in Ohio, mostly in letters he wrote back to Sally, his wife, doesn't even mention any interaction with Emma Smith. Emma, of course, had been commanded to gather hymns, and in 1832, when Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon and Newell K. Whitney and a couple of others arrived with paper so that they could start printing things, the newspaper and preparation for the Book of Commandments. This was in April of 1832. And it was after that that the newspaper came out and they started working on the Book of Commandments and printing it. In that meeting of the literary firm, Joseph Smith, under God's inspiration, assigned W.W. Phelps to print the hymns. And he went forward. Well, he apparently received some of them by mail. Maybe even Joseph Smith brought a few of them from Emma Smith. We have in The Evening and the Morning Star a few selected hymns. They're called selected hymns. And they were Protestant hymns. And we're assuming, not knowing 100%, but we're assuming that Emma Smith selected those Protestant hymns to be involved in the Latter-day Saint hymnal. And then when Phelps was in Ohio in September of 1835 in a council meeting, he again was assigned to print and publish the hymnal. But by this time, he had written 20 of his own restoration hymns. And then he wrote a few more before publishing it. The last one of those few more was The Spirit of God Like a Fire of Burning, which he was planning to use in the dedication of the House of the Lord that was about ready to take place in early 1836. It was delayed clear until late March, but he published that in January 1836. Well, it turns out that there were 90 hymns in that pocketbook-sized hymnal. He wrote 25 of those entirely by himself, and then he took several from Protestant hymns, maybe some of them selected by Emma Smith. We don't No, but he took a few of them and revised them and put Mormon millennial language into them. Even the one that we now sing at Christmas, Joy to the World, the Lord Will Come, is what he put in there. He made it when he wrote that hymn and put it in the evening and the more, pardon me, in the Messenger and Advocate, he called it the Second Coming. Joy to the world, the Lord will come, and made an emphasis that way. And saints and angels sing rather than heaven and angels sing. So that was one of the revisions. Well, of the 90 hymns, he wrote 25 by himself and revised 37 others. So by far the majority of the hymns were with his hand, and then that left about 25 that probably were selected by Emma Smith. That's true. We know that Joseph Smith and Emma had taken Phelps in as a boarder When he arrived and lived along with his son, he took his son with him, a teenager named Waterman Phelps. So W.W. Phelps and Waterman Phelps were boarders in Joseph Smith's home there in Kirtland, real close to the house of the Lord. He obviously interacted with her to a certain extent, except he never wrote about that. He wrote all sorts of things about what was going on, mostly male-centric, I admit that, about in the printing office and with Joseph Smith and building the house of the Lord and the councils they were having. He didn't mention anything about Emma other than that first time he arrived as a boarder. He obviously interacted with her. So I've come to the conclusion that the first hymn book was 80% his product and maybe 20% hers. I'm not trying to put her down because I love Emma Smith. But I don't think that she deserves the credit for the first hymnal. I think the credit primarily goes to him.
Oh, that's interesting. So he probably did at least, well, you said 80%. I was thinking 2/3. Well, that's interesting. That first hymn book only had words, right? It didn't have actual music?
That is correct. In fact, all of the early hymnals in America were the same way. On the book, it actually shows the first page of the hymnal. And it is true that her name is in there. I think Joseph Smith wanted to be sure that his wife got that credit, and that adds to the mystery. Well, okay, it must be Emma Smith's then. There is a preface that is in the next couple pages, and it's definitely in Phelps's linguistic style, and all sorts of historians recognize that Phelps must have written this. However, in that recent biography, the author felt that Emma Smith may have written it, but it really, she's not one who wrote a lot of things anyway, and it certainly was in Phelps's style.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Bruce Van Orden. In our next conversation, we'll talk about Phelps' rivalry with Thomas B. Marsh.
And I think that Marsh always wanted to be very important and to be a leader and to be recognized as such. He did have that egocentric, driven way of doing things. And so they plotted together to try to get rid of Phelps and John Whitmer as the leadership. They held proceedings, illegal ones, according to the revelation that had been given about how courts were to be handled.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please subscribe for just $5 a month at patreon.com/gospeltangents, and you can hear the entire interview before everybody else. If you'd like to watch the entire video for just $8 a month, you can either subscribe on YouTube, Patreon, or my website, gospeltangents.com. Just click the yellow subscribe button, and I'll add you to our Gospel Tangents Insiders group so that you can see entire videos. For those interested in a PDF transcript, you can subscribe at either Patreon or on my website. For just $10 a month, I'll send you a PDF as soon as it's complete. If you'd like a copy of the paperback as well as a PDF, just sign up for $20 a month at either Patreon or my website, gospeltangents.com. Of course, you can buy individual transcripts at amazon.com and just do a search for Gospel Tangents Interview and you can see all the things that we have there. Don't forget to support Gospel Tangents with an awesome t-shirt like one of these. You can subscribe at Apple Podcasts at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. Get our latest updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Also, you can get our Twitter updates at gospeltangents. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got more of our great videos. Thanks again.